Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bow 241. It's October 30th, which means you have less than 24 hours to find your costume for tomorrow. Okay, and there's no test, so you can wear any kind of costume you want tomorrow. It's fine with me. So today's the 30th. I don't know if we're going to get to endocrinology, but we're supposed to get to endocrinology today. We need to finish up some stuff in sensory physiology before getting to endo. And let's see, the next exam is November 15th. And that's going to be on a Thursday. So that's a couple of weeks away yet, so that's good. We still got time. All right, so let's see, where are we in? The PowerPoints are here. Oh, there was something I wanted to pull up before I started this slideshow right here. Yeah, the ear. There was something on the ear. I think we're pretty much done talking about the ear, except the synopsis page, which you can find in Blackboard. I do want to go over that really quick. So let's see, how can I get to Blackboard? Here we go. Okay, now I'm not sure I know where this thing is at. Probably let's look under course documents first. Ah, here. Structures and functions of the labyrinth. All right, so here is a nice synopsis of everything that we talked about last time. And you should be familiar with this. And so let's see if we can zoom. Pretty close. Okay, that's going to work. Okay, so for the ear, how many senses do you have in your ear? There are actually three. There's hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. Another way of saying that is number one is hearing. Number two, static equilibrium is the same thing as linear acceleration, so a linear change in velocity, not a constant velocity, but the velocity has to be changing. And then the third one is what we call kinetic equilibrium or spinning or angular acceleration. All right, so you're going to be changing the rate at which you spin. So if you're spinning at a constant speed, then that's not going to stimulate those receptors. It's got to be acceleration, which is a change in speed. All right, so what parts, how many parts are there to an ear? There are three parts to an ear. There's an external, middle, and internal ear. And you should have on the tip of your tongue what parts of those pieces of the ear are important for those three modalities of sensation. All right, so you got external ear, middle ear, and internal ear. And for the sense of hearing, what parts do you need? You need all of them, right? So you need the external acoustic meatus, you need the auditory ossicles, right? And you need structures in the inner ear, for instance, like the cochlea and organ of Corti and all that kind of stuff. All right, now what about for the second sense? Linear acceleration or static equilibrium. Yeah, you can sense static equilibrium just fine without an external ear, without a middle ear, but not without an inner ear, okay? Because you need the labyrinth. And the same thing for kinetic equilibrium. All right, and then specifically, what is the bony labyrinth for these three senses? And the bony labyrinth is found in the inner ear, the internal ear, right, inside the petrous region of the temporal bone, and it's called the cochlea, the thing that looks like a snail, the vestibule for linear acceleration, it's just kind of a bulge right by the oval window, and then the semicircular canals for angular acceleration. Right, so those are the three bony labyrinths. Then there's a membranous labyrinth inside these bony structures, and for hearing, it's the cochlear duct. And for static equilibrium, it's the utricle and saccule. And for angular acceleration, it's the semicircular ducts. Okay, and then the receptor organ you should know as well. Organ of Corti for hearing. So if somebody has damage to that organ right there, maybe they can get a hearing aid, okay, or a cochlear implant to this region right here that might improve their hearing. The receptor organ for static equilibrium are the maculae, right, and the crista ampullaris for angular acceleration. And all of these organs right here have a special receptor cell. And what is strange about that is that it is exactly the same receptor cell. They're hair cells that have stereocilia, kinocilia on them. And when those stereocilia bend one way or the other, maybe due to vibration if it's sound, right, or if it's some otoliths pushing on the hair cells, as in static equilibrium, that get them to bend, or whether it's fluid pushing on the stereocilia in the semicircular canals that changes the electrical properties of those hair cells, then that changes action potentials or the rate of action potentials going through the brain. So the receptor cells are exactly the same. So you should be familiar with this little table, and you have that in Blackboard. Okay, so that's it for hearing, or the ear, actually, unless somebody's got a question on hearing. If not, then we're going to move on to vision. All right, so that's just kind of a review from anatomy for you. All right, so vision. What kind of sense is vision? Is it a general or a special sense? It's special because you can only see in a couple very discrete locations on your body, and that's your eyes. So the eyes can transduce light energy in particular into action potentials, right? And that energy that the lights are, that your eyes are sensitive to, are just from a small part of the total electromagnetic spectrum. So this first graph that we have right here is just a line, and you can see that it just tells you at what wavelength certain kinds of radiation, what the name of that radiation is. Right, so from, and this is in angstrom units, so from anywhere from 10 to the 14th, that's a huge number, that's 10 times 10 times 10 is 14 times over. Radio waves, oh, I got to get my cursor back. Where'd it go? Okay, radio waves are very long wavelengths. Right, and as a matter of fact, these are low energy wavelengths. So as the wavelength gets bigger, the energy of that wave gets smaller and smaller. It's inversely related. And then a little bit shorter wavelength is microwave, and a little bit shorter than that is infrared, and then these are a little bit higher in energy compared to radio waves. And then the visible light spectrum is right in here, just a really small area. And that can be expanded out, and we see this on a nice color diagram, and that just kind of looks like a rainbow, right? So here's the color spectrum that's included just in this region of the electromagnetic spectrum. A little bit higher energy wavelength would be ultraviolet, and even higher than that is X-ray, and even higher and shorter in wavelength would be gamma rays. So our eyes are sensitive to these wavelengths right here, because this visible light, at least when somebody has normal vision, right, this kind of electromagnetic energy or wavelength can be transduced by the retina into action potentials, right? Because that's the language of the nervous system. All of these other wavelengths right here might have an effect on the retina, might have an effect on biological tissue, but they won't result in action potentials going to the occipital lobe. So some of the effect might be damaging to the retina, right? So you always have to read the question to see how a question might be asked. For instance, is the retina sensitive to microwaves or to ultraviolet light? All right, if the meaning of that question is can it transduce that energy into action potentials? And you would say yes, but if it's just a damaging effect, then I would say then it's not sensitive in the proper sense. Okay, so this is just a visible light spectrum. All right, and I think the structure of the eye, probably went over this in lab and certainly from anatomy. The iris, and you're familiar with this also from knowing how to use a microscope, because a microscope has something that's similar to an iris that's in your eye that's called what? Does anybody remember what it's called on a microscope? It's called the iris diaphragm, and it's something that you can adjust to adjust the amount of light that is moving through the specimen and into your eyes just so that you can see what's going on, so it's not too bright or too dark. All right, the iris in us is a pigmented muscle, and a pigment, anybody, did I ever talk about a pigment? What's a pigment? What the heck is a pigment? What is a pigment? It's a chemical compound, okay, it's a chemical compound that can absorb specific wavelengths of light. All right, so for instance, let's see. Well, I'm lost when I look at this little color diagram right here. RGB. So blue probably is right over here because I remember how these colors kind of go. All right, so blue is probably in this region right here. Violet is over. How am I doing? Violet is in this region? Okay, because that's right at the end. Okay, and red is over here. Maybe let's stick with red. All right, so if something looks red, like we're looking right here, it has a chemical compound that is absorbing yellow and green and blue and violet, but not the red wavelength. The red light hits that particular pigment and bounces off of it so that it enters your eye so you can perceive it. So something that looks red is not really colored red, it's just reflecting red to your eye. And something that looks yellow is absorbing what? Red and blues and violets and greens, but it's reflecting the yellow light back to you. So in order for a pigment to absorb light, it's going to absorb the things that you can't see coming off of it. So I always wonder why plants don't have black leaves, because what would that mean? That means that plants would absorb all the energy coming from the sun, okay, to make glucose out of it. But they're green colored, so plants that are green, and this is green in this region right here. Yeah, this is green pretty much right smack in the middle. So plants have the ability to absorb red colored wavelengths and blue colored wavelengths, but not these green colored wavelengths, because that's what gets reflected back to your eye. Okay, so that energy is lost to plants. I don't know how that happened. It's probably a reason for it. Okay, so let's get back to this iris. It is pigmented, which means what? Since it's pigmented, it can absorb light. So a pigment is just something that absorbs light. And depending on what color it is, right, it can absorb just a little bit of light energy or a whole broad spectrum of energy. And it just so happens that the iris can absorb a lot, but some people's irises don't absorb blue. It reflects it back, right? And so they have a blue colored eye. But nonetheless, it absorbs light. So it can act as a shield or prevent light from entering the eye. That's its job. So the iris, there's a hole. What do we call a hole in anatomy?
Foramen.
A foramen. So there's a foramen in the iris, but we don't call it a foramen. But I want to present it to you as a foramen because everybody should know what the function of a foramen is. What's the function of a foramen? It's a passageway for something, right? So here is a foramen in the iris of the eye. It's a passageway for light in particular, and we call it the pupil. Okay, so here's the pupil, that's a foramen in the iris, and you can see that it can change shape, it can dilate, it can get really big. And when it gets big like that, then it lets a lot of light into the eye, and that's what happens under dim light conditions. All right, so, and that is under the control of the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, because there are different arrangements of fascicles of muscles within the iris. We have radial muscles right here, and we also have circular muscles. And it just so happens that the sympathetic stimulation causes contraction of the radial fibers right here, which then pulls the foramen open, pulls the pupil open. It dilates the pupil, and it lets a lot of light in. So maybe relate that to our last lecture. When would it be good for you to have dilated pupils? Under what kind of circumstances? Fight or flight or rest and digest? Okay. Dilated pupils? When you're fight or flight, so that you can observe, so you have high acuity and have good sensitivity to light, so you can see things happening around you under sympathetic stimulation. Okay, under under bright light conditions or in the rest and digest condition, the radial fibers are relaxed and the circular fibers contract. And when that happens, the pupil constricts, it gets smaller. And that's under parasympathetic stimulation. And don't forget, your pupil reaches the exact proper size under most conditions of light because there's going to be a balance, a mixing of sympathetic and parasympathetic information. Remember, because these things provide for precise control and balance over pupil diameter. Okay. So that is what adjusts your pupil diameter. Now, what do I want to say about cervical ganglia or oculomotor nerve? Probably not too much, but you can look at that on this slide. Okay, accommodation is another kind of process. It happens a little bit when light intensity changes, but it's more important when you're looking at what the distance is, the object that you're trying to focus on, what the distance is away from your eye. So you can focus on something close up or far away, but you can't focus on both at the same time. You have to choose what you want to look at. And you probably did this experiment in lab where you put your fingernail out in front of you at arm's length, which is pretty close. And if you focus on your fingernail and look at the background, what can you tell me about the background if your fingernail is in focus? It's blurry, right? So you can't have both in focus. And then if you keep your fingernail there and focus on the background, what happens to your fingernail? Yeah, I see about 10 of them right there. Maybe 2, 10. It keeps flipping back and forth. All right, so you get to pick what you want to focus on. So something has to change in the eye so that you can see something close up or far away and not exactly at the same time. That process is called accommodation, and it's the result of the change in shape of the lens. So the lens has to change shape so that the image that you're looking at stays in sharp focus. There's a muscle that surrounds the lens and is connected to the lens by suspensory ligaments. And when the activity of that muscle, which we call the ciliary muscle, changes, then the shape of the lens is going to change because it's going to change the tension on the suspensory ligaments. So this is a little strange. I want to go over it a little bit because we all know that a muscle can't push on anything, it can only pull. But this system is kind of an inverse system a little bit, and you'll see what I mean in just a second. Okay, so at distances greater than 20 feet, so you're looking at something far away from you, and it could be off in infinity someplace, right? The ciliary muscle relaxes. So here's that circular ciliary muscle, and when it relaxes, remember one property of muscle is that it is elastic, which means that if you push it together and then release the tension, it goes back to its original length. Or if you stretch a muscle and release the tension, it goes back to its original length. All right, so when the ciliary muscle relaxes, the circle gets bigger. The diameter of the ciliary muscle gets bigger because of the elastic properties of that muscle. And then it puts tension on the suspensory ligaments when the ciliary body relaxes. And that's what puts tension on the lens and makes the lens flatter when that happens. All right, so when the ciliary muscle relaxes, the lens gets flatter. And as a result, it can't bend light quite as much. But the reason why that works is because when an object gets farther and farther away from you, the light rays are approaching your eyes that are very parallel to each other. As the object gets closer and closer, the light rays are more divergent. They're moving farther and farther away from each other. So as an object gets closer, your eye has to take those divergent light beams and then refocus them so that they're at a single point on the retina. So as something gets closer, you need a stronger and stronger lens in your eye. And that can be accomplished by changing the curvature of the lens. And indeed, it does change. So as an object approaches your eye, the light rays are more divergent. So we need a stronger lens inside the eye to focus it on the retina. So what happens is that the ciliary muscle contracts, the circle, the diameter of the circle gets smaller, and that reduces the tension on the suspensory ligaments, which reduces tension on the lens, and when the lens relaxes, it goes back to something that has a lot more curvature, which can bend light to a greater degree to focus it on the retina. All right, so that's kind of a strange system. You'll have to look at that. Okay, it's funny because when the muscle relaxes, that's what puts tension on the suspensory ligaments. And when the muscle contracts, that's what releases tension on the suspensory ligaments. That's kind of opposite compared to how we think of a musculoskeletal system. Usually when a muscle contracts, it puts tension on a tendon. Okay, but not so with the for this process of accommodation. Okay, and unfortunately, there are some age-related effects that happen here. Right, the lens, as we get older, doesn't like to change shape quite so quickly, and maybe not to the same degree. So as we get older, we need reading glasses because the lens just doesn't like to go, it loses its elastic properties. Right, you might need reading glasses as a result of that. Okay, and other kinds of changes. All right, another topic, visual acuity, has to do with the shape of the eyeball and how far away an object is. So I see on this diagram right here, which is kind of okay, I see a bunch of light rays entering the eye, and I see that these light rays are all parallel to each other, which by the previous discussion means that the object that this eyeball is looking at is far away. Okay, is far away. And it's the case in each one of these diagrams right here, which doesn't help us in our discussion exactly a lot, but we'll work around it. Okay, so the resolving power is the ability to see two closely spaced objects, to see a separation between them. So if we have a normal eyeball, here's a normal eyeball, we call that emmetropia with normal vision. We have light rays entering the eye, and they go through the lens, and they actually go through the cornea right here, and they get bent back to focus on a single point. So all of these light rays are coming from just a single point in space. Right, just one single point. They're not coming from a broad region in space, but just a single point. And by the time these light rays reach the eye, they're pretty much parallel because it's far away from the eye. Nonetheless, in order to see just one point, all these light rays have to be focused right on the retina. All right, so you can see if the eyeball is shorter, then these light rays aren't going to focus at one point. They're going to focus in a big, broad area of the retina. It's going to look blurry. Or if the eyeball's too long, then would they focus way in front? And again, it's going to look like a blurry vision. So if the length of the distance, I'm sorry, if the distance from the lens to the retina right here is such that these light rays focus to a certain point, then no correction is necessary and everything will look really, really sharp. Okay. But in a circumstance where somebody is nearsighted, that means that their eyeball is too long. Okay, we call that myopia. Somebody's eyeball is too long compared to the curvature that's produced by the lens. These light rays are going to focus very sharply before they get to the retina. And then as they proceed into the retina, they're going to defocus once again and things will start to look blurry. Okay, so this is what we call myopia. And a way to correct that is with a concave lens. And a concave lens will spread the light rays out before they enter the eye. So if they're spread out before they enter the eye, then it takes a longer distance for them to focus on the retina. So this is just a corrective way for myopia to take place. All right, but somebody could have not an eyeball that's too long, but one that's too short. If it's too short, then the light rays are going to focus way behind the retina, which means then that we have to place a lens in front of the eye to get these light rays bending together before they enter the eye, right? And that's what's done with a convex lens. And we call that hyperopia or farsightedness, okay? Because the light is focused without correction way behind the retina, okay? Now, these discussions presume that the lens and the cornea has a nice spherical shape to it and has the same curvature, whether you move from the center to the right, from the center to the left, from the center to the top, or center to the bottom, it has the same curvature, but that's not necessarily the case. You might have a lens that has more curvature on the bottom than on the top, and what that does then is produces an astigmatism. So depending on where the light rays hit the lens, they're going to be bent to a lesser or greater degree. And in that case, then you need an uneven lens to compensate for the unevenness of the lens or that astigmatism. So that if you look at, in lab, if somebody has an astigmatism, if you look at the acuity chart, you might see some part, which is in just a flat plane, you might see one part of the chart in focus, but another part out of focus. Okay, if somebody with myopia looks at a chart, the whole thing will be in focus or out of focus at one time, but not just certain segments of it. With astigmatism, just some part of that chart will be out of focus. Okay. All right, so let's look at the retina in particular. And in the retina, all right, so let's look at the layers of the eye. There are three main layers of the eye, as you can recall from anatomy. The outer layer, the toughest layer of the eye, is called the sclera, and it looks white, a lot of connective tissue. It's not quite as hard as an eggshell, but it's even tougher. It's like shoe leather, right? So that actually what creates the shape of the eye, and actually I want to go back to this slide over here, okay, and talk about a couple things. The shape of the eye, since that stimulated my imagination a little bit. Okay, maybe this is you right now in this period of time. Okay, your eyeball is too long. But as you live your life, of course your face can change, okay, and the shape of your eyeball can change. It might get longer or it might get shorter. And if you have a long eyeball right now and it gets shorter, what happens to your vision? It gets better, not worse, right? So it is possible for somebody's vision to improve with age, right? Because if the shape of the eyeball just changes in the right way, your vision will get better. Or if your eyeball is too long and it proceeds to get longer, then what happens? Well, then your vision gets worse and worse over time. And then, for instance, if your eyeball is too long and it gets shorter, your vision gets better. And then if it continues to shorten, what happens? Then it gets worse the other way. So your vision is going to change your whole lifetime, right? And you should just get your eyes checked. But of course, you should get checked for glaucoma every year anyway, right? That's not just for, and maybe we can talk about glaucoma sometime. Maybe you did in lab. All right, so there is a nice procedure called a LASIK procedure, because not only does the lens bend light, but look at the shape of the cornea right here. The shape of the cornea looks like a lens. And actually, the cornea has more lens power than the lens does inside your eye. So the most important part of your eye for focusing light is actually the cornea. The only job that the lens produces is it gives you the ability to change your depth of focus from what you're looking at. Okay. So when somebody has an eyeball that's way too long, right, somebody figured out, well, let's just change the shape of the cornea right here, and then this lens might work properly so that they can see things in focus. And the cornea is really easy to get at because it's right there on the surface of your eyeball. We don't have to be digging around and doing any surgery back here in the posterior segment or with the lens itself, anything in the anterior segment of the eye. And with a laser, that's possible to do that. Okay, just by measuring the distance from the lens to the retina, then somebody can calculate what the curvature of the cornea should be in order for you to see perfectly with that LASIK procedure. And so then the epithelium from the cornea is removed, and a couple cell layers from the cornea then are burned away with a laser in less than a second. And then the cornea changes shape so that it matches up with the length of your eyeball, and people are amazed that now they have better than normal vision right after that procedure. Okay, but what can you tell me about your vision over time? It changes. So that procedure works for your eyeball on that particular day. And if your vision changes a lot over your lifetime, then that LASIK procedure will be ineffective. And I think now they've figured out a way how they can redo a LASIK procedure. Early on, they couldn't do it. Now the procedure probably can be redone a couple of times as your vision changes. All right, but the other thing about that LASIK procedure is, for instance, when you correct for far vision, okay, what happens, it makes your near vision worse as a result of the LASIK procedure. So I've known a lot of people to get a LASIK procedure because they wanted to correct their far vision. They didn't want to have glasses, okay, and they go get their vision corrected, and within less than a second, they have near perfect vision for far away. They're really happy, and I can understand why they would be really happy about that. And then they get a call on their cell phone and get the cell phone out of their pocket, and guess what? They can't use their cell phone because they can't see it. Because there's a trade-off between far vision and near vision. All right, so that's always something. When you talk to a physician about this LASIK procedure, make sure you go to a reputable physician that will educate you about all of these things, the trade-offs that are involved. Okay, because what you're going to be trading off is glasses for far vision compared to glasses for reading. Okay, so it all depends. But So I don't know if I recommend the LASIK procedure just for cosmetic reasons, but if you have good financial reasons or medical reasons, like if you're a pro football player or a pro boxer and you're going to earn $5 million to go fight somebody in a boxing ring, I wouldn't wear my glasses in there. I would get a LASIK procedure, right? But if it's just to come to school, I'd probably wear glasses or contact lenses or something. But if my vision was so poor that I couldn't even find my glasses in the morning, then a LASIK procedure is wonderful. It will change your life, right? So that's really handy. So make sure that you consult with somebody that knows all of the issues, who have the anatomy and the physiology of the eye. So let's continue with some of the physiology of the eye, in particular, the layer of the eye that is important for vision. All right, so we talked about the sclera that just shapes the eyeball, protects the eyeball, gives its shape, but you can see how when you change the shape of the eye, you're changing the function and how you see. All right, so the sclera is pretty important. The next deepest layer is the choroid, and the choroid is most notable because it has the vascular supply. It supplies nutrient and oxygen to the sclera as well as to the retina. So that's why it is important. And then being attached to the choroid is the retina. And it has to be attached to the choroid because what moves oxygen into the retina and nutrients and waste products out of the retina is just by diffusion. So these things have to be in contact with each other and in close proximity. So here is the retina. It's not really drawn to scale because they wanted to put in a bunch of pieces right here. But the most important things that we see here are the photoreceptor cells. And the photoreceptor cells could be these thin, long cells that we call rods, or some that have kind of a conical tip to them. We call this a cone cell. And this is kind of drawn inappropriately because the rods are actually thicker than the cones. The cone cells are smaller. All right, so the rod cells, because they're bigger, they can absorb more light, they're more sensitive, they can absorb more signal to be transmitted to your visual cortex. And since the cone cells are small, right, they're not as sensitive to light, but they give you better resolution because they pick up light from a smaller area. All right, and the cone cells are important for color vision. The rod cells only allow you to see in a gray scale, black and white or degrees of gray. Okay, so those are some of the differences between rods and cones. The cone cells are what we have in our central vision. And does anybody remember the spot in the retina that's centrally located? It actually has two names. There's a spot inside of a spot. But the macula lutea is very sensitive. It has a lot of cones. And then the very center of the macula lutea is 100% cone cells. That's called the fovea centralis. All right, so the fovea centralis gives you your best color vision and highest acuity, but you need bright light to see. The rod cells, on the other hand, since they're bigger, they give you less spatial resolution, less resolution, less acuity, right? And you can only see in black and white, but they're very sensitive. You can see in dim light. Those are in your peripheral vision. All right, so that's something about the distribution of those cells and what they're good for. When we looked at the nervous system, we saw that there's a special kind of neuron that we find only in special sensory organs, and that are the bipolar cells. All right, so the rod cells then adjust the electrical properties or the electrical physiology inside the bipolar cells right here, and then the bipolar cells will then stimulate the nerve cells of the optic nerve that then takes information into the central nervous system. Okay, and then there's some other cells that are scattered around, like these amacrine cells and horizontal cells, which help adjust your vision as you're looking at something. And we're not going to get into the function of amacrine and horizontal cells, but we do want to talk about these photoreceptor cells and the bipolar cells. And we don't really have to learn anything new about this optic nerve because these are just nice multipolar neurons, and you're familiar with how a multipolar neuron works. Right, the receiving end is the dendrite and the axon is the sending end. And the sending end what does the sending end of a neuron send? Action potentials, right, which is the automatic language of the nervous system. All right, so the outer layer, the most superficial layer of the eye is the sclera. The deepest layer is the retina. Light enters the cornea and it's going to strike the retina first, but it's got to go over all of these neurons before it gets to the photoreceptor cells. Right, so it's got to pass through all these neurons, and then the light can even pass through the photoreceptor cells and bounce into the choroid and even this pigmented epithelium. And since it's a pigmented epithelium, what could you tell me about it? It has a pigment, which does what? It absorbs light, so that when light bounces into your eye, it gets shined in your eye, it doesn't go to the back of your eye and then bounce back out, because then you'll see flashes of light inside your eye, or maybe images won't be superimposed just right. But actually, some animals find that really helpful, because when light enters the eye and bounces back out, it can re-stimulate these photoreceptor cells, and it makes their vision much more sensitive in dim light conditions. Like your cats and dogs, if you ever shine a light in their eyes, they have a special part of the choroid called the tapetum lucidum that's kind of silvery. And when you shine light in their eyes at night, their eyes actually look like they're glowing a little bit, because some of the light is actually being reflected back at you. Okay. So that's the arrangement of the retina. Okay, so amacrine and horizontal cells for some signal processing, visual processing before it gets to the optic nerve. All right, let's look at some of these cells in particular. Now you can see the cone cell is a lot smaller than the rod cell, and it's got a couple different divisions. There's an inner segment and an outer segment. So the inner segment is pointing to where the light is coming from. This outer segment is pointing to the more superficial layers of the eye. And it has segments, okay, that can absorb light. They contain stacks of photopigment. There are discs that can absorb light in the outer segment of both the rod and cone cells. Okay, and these are replaced all the time at the base, and then they're removed at the tip, and so that material doesn't build up inside the retina. That's another reason for that epithelium to exist, right, to recycle these cellular components. And as far as I know, these rod cones and rod cells and cone cells don't ever regenerate. The ones that you have right now are the only ones you're going to have for the rest of your life, because they're like a neuron. Okay. Okay, I think I talked about that already. All right, so there's a compound in the disc that we call rhodopsin. And so here is rhodopsin. It's got two parts to it. There's a protein, okay, that we call opsin, and then another compound that we call retinol. And these two have the right shape under certain circumstances to where they fit together. So opsin has like an active site that retinol can fit into, right? But when this compound is subjected to light, depending on the exact nature of this chemical compound and the energy of light or the color of light that's hitting it, it can change a conformation, right, of the retinol molecule. So instead of it being a curved molecule like this, which is in a cis configuration, this might remind you of some fatty acids when we were talking about cis and trans configurations of fatty acids. So this cis configuration has a bend to this hydrocarbon chain, but when it absorbs light, it causes a conformation change, not a change in the chemical per se, but just in the arrangement of this backbone, so it becomes a straight molecule. And when it's straight, it can't fit into the active site of opsin anymore, and these two things dissociate. And we call that the bleaching reaction. Bleaching reaction happens when rhodopsin absorbs light and retinol dissociates from opsin. Okay, and then that's going to change the electrical properties of the cell, of either a rod cell or a cone cell. And as a matter of fact, only the rod cells have rhodopsin. The cone cells have other kinds of pigments in them for absorbing different colors of light. All right, so let's just talk about black and white vision probably for the rest of the lecture due to the rod cells that contain rhodopsin. All right, so how can this change the permeability of ions across the cell membrane in a rod cell when this thing dissociates? That's what we're interested in physiology. Okay. So the ganglion cells and amacrine cells produce action potentials. Rods, cones, bipolar, horizontal cells produce graded potentials. And you should kind of remember the difference between them. And the ganglion cell sends action potentials to the brain for your perception of light. But it's these graded potentials in the bipolar cells, right, that can either change the intensity, because graded potentials can summate, and they can even subtract from each other. The strange thing about the visual system is that the visual transduction system is really the inverse of other sensory systems in the body. so that when a stimulus is applied to a receptor, that usually causes excitation on a receptor cell. And how do we explain excitation in terms of ion channels and membrane permeability? Excitation is depolarization. Usually when a sodium channel opens, that causes depolarization, and that brings the membrane potential up to threshold or closer to when an action potential can be instigated on a neuron. Okay, but that's not so with the visual system. We're going to have to look at a couple of diagrams for that to make sense, but I got a couple of pictures to show you. In the visual system, light inhibits photoreceptors from releasing an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So we have inhibition of an inhibition when we look at the visual system, which is kind of hard to think about. Okay? And when that inhibition is inhibited, that stimulates the bipolar cells into producing action potentials in the ganglion cells. So let's take a look and see how this happens. All right, so I might come back to some of these slides. So here is a disc in an outer segment of a rod cell. So we're specifically going to look at a rod cell. And here we have cis retinol. And under what conditions is retinol in a cis configuration, which is the bent configuration? It's in a dark condition when it's not absorbing light. Okay, so when it's not absorbing light, we have rhodopsin that's put together, and also in the disc we have a G protein. So you can consider rhodopsin like the receptor, and then here we have the usual kind of G protein. So it's a receptor G protein coupled complex, but it's not an ion channel. Right? This is just the activation of the G protein. When rhodopsin absorbs light, it changes the configuration of retinol to the all trans form. So here I can see a little light ray coming in. When it absorbs that light, then it causes dissociation of the G protein from the disc, and it just so happens that the alpha subunit moves away and can float around inside the cytosol of a disc, and it can bump into an enzyme. This enzyme is called phosphodiesterase. In the dark condition, phosphodiesterase is inactive, but when light is present, right, this alpha subunit binds to phosphodiesterase, and when it does, that's like your friend poking you in the side. What happens to you when your friend pokes you in the side? We change configuration, right? So now phosphodiesterase has become activated under these conditions, and a phosphodiesterase is an enzyme that can convert a cyclic AMP or a cyclic GMP into, it can uncycle it from making it a circle to just a linear molecule. Okay, cyclic GMP, when it's in a circular form, can bind to a sodium channel, and again, that's like poking you in the side. Right, that opens the sodium channel up in the dark. So if the sodium channel is open, which way is sodium going to move? From outside to inside, because typically it's high on the outside. And when sodium enters the cell, okay, in the dark condition, okay, what happens to the cell? It becomes depolarized. It becomes excited. All right, so this is one of the photoreceptor cells. In the dark, it's excited and will release a neurotransmitter in the dark. Okay, when light hits the photoreceptor, that activates phosphodiesterase, it takes cyclic GMP, which is a circular molecule, changes configuration so it's a nice linear molecule or just regular old GMP, doesn't fit into the sodium channel anymore, it comes off, and that changes the conformation of this sodium channel. It closes. So when we close a sodium channel, what happens to the membrane potential? Remember, when a sodium channel is open, it causes depolarization, but when a sodium channel closes, it causes hyperpolarization. And what do you understand about hyperpolarization? Is it excitatory or inhibitory? It inhibits the cell, right? So when light hits the cell, it inhibits these sodium channels, inhibits the cell, and it stops releasing neurotransmitter, okay? It stops releasing neurotransmitter in the light conditions. So that's why we call this sodium entering the cell a sodium dark current. Sodium enters the cell, becomes excited under dark conditions when there's no light hitting the eye. All right, I need another slide or two in order for this to make sense. And then maybe start at the beginning again. Okay, so here we have, all right, on this slide we have two conditions. We have a dark condition and a light condition. On this slide we have a dark condition and a light condition. And we are talking about not the cone cells, but the rod cells, because they're a little bit easier to understand. Okay, so let's look at this, the dark condition first. And what do we have? We have a rod cell, we have a bipolar cell, and we have a ganglion cell. So we're not going to consider the amacrine or horizontal cells in our physiology, but just these three, which will be good enough to understand how the eye works. All right, so here's the outer segment. Here's the inner segment of a rod cell. And the outer segment has the photoreceptor discs in there with rhodopsin. And in the dark, okay, the G protein doesn't dissociate from rhodopsin, which means that phosphodiesterase is inactive. When phosphodiesterase is inactive, then there's plenty of cyclic GMP inside the cell because there's no active phosphodiesterase. So cyclic GMP can bind to the sodium channel, and what it does, it keeps the sodium channel open. So in the dark, sodium is entering the cell. We call that the dark current. That is exciting the cell. It's stimulating the cell. And since the cell is depolarizing, it's releasing neurotransmitter. But this neurotransmitter is kind of interesting because it's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So in the dark, since it's releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter, the bipolar cell is being hyperpolarized or inhibited. So in the dark, even though the rod cell releases neurotransmitter, this bipolar cell is hyperpolarized or is inhibited in the dark. All right, so here we have kind of an interesting system where you have depolarization inhibiting the bipolar cell. And if it's inhibiting the bipolar cells, then action potentials don't develop on the ganglion cell and the action potentials don't go to the brain. Action potentials don't go to the brain under what conditions? Dark conditions. Okay, so that's how you have to follow through this particular slide. All right, well, let's, and of course, these conditions are maintained by the sodium-potassium pump so that, you know, not all the sodium in the whole universe ends up inside the cell. So that maintains this sodium current. All right, so let's go to the other circumstance. When there is light present, when light is present, okay, then we have the bleaching reaction. Retinol dissociates from rhodopsin under those conditions, and then that retinol can bind with the phosphodiesterase, and no, it activates the G protein, and the alpha unit of the subprotein of the G protein can bind to phosphodiesterase, right? Changes conformation that activates phosphodiesterase, which then eats up a bunch of cyclic GMP inside the cell. It has to come off of the sodium channel. And when it does, it gets converted into just regular old linear GMP. And so that changes the conformation of the sodium channel. It closes it. So what happens to the electrical properties of this rod cell when this sodium channel, which is normally open, closes? Okay? In the dark, it's depolarized, but in the light, it becomes hyperpolarized or inhibited. And when this cell is inhibited, what happens to release of neurotransmitter? It goes away. But don't forget that neurotransmitter is inhibitory, so now this bipolar cell is not inhibited, right? It has sodium channels that are causing depolarization. It's not inhibited now, so now the bipolar cell will release excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, and that's an excitatory neurotransmitter, brings it closer to threshold, so that's going to create action potentials going to the visual cortex. Right, and action potentials go to the visual cortex under what kind of conditions? Light conditions. But those are the conditions that inhibit the rod cell. But don't forget, it's the rod cell that inhibits the bipolar cell. So when we inhibit the rod cell, that releases the bipolar cell to stimulate the ganglion cell. So it's kind of a weird system. So you're going to have to look at that a couple of times. So I didn't read the previous slides, but after you look at these diagrams a couple of times and go back and read these slides, guess what? It will make a little sense to you. Okay. All right, so depolarizing sodium influx is the dark current under dark condition, right? And that causes the release of inhibitory neurotransmitter on the bipolar cell. But light hyperpolarizes, closing these sodium channels, and that stops the release of inhibitory neurotransmitter on bipolar cells, which then will send action potentials to the brain via the ganglion cells. Okay, I think that's the last slide. It is the last slide. So we do get to talk about endocrine system a little bit. Okay. So I don't know if you can ask me any questions about that, but I'd be happy to answer some questions next time after you get to study that a little bit. You have to change, you got to sit upside down or change your mind inside out or something, because it's not just the usual kind of thing. But just rely on your basic principles. Right? When sodium enters the cell, that depolarizes. When sodium stops entering the cell, that's the same thing as hyperpolarizing or inhibiting the cell. Okay, that's why we spent a lot of time talking about some of those things early on. All right, so the next chapter, endocrine system, that's chapter 11. Okay, and 11 will be on the next test, so we got to get to it. Okay. So we're going to start with some nice basic definitions of what the endocrine system is, what is an endocrine gland. An endocrine gland secretes something. Does anybody know what an endocrine gland secretes? A hormone, that's right. So now we need to come up with a good definition for a hormone so we know if a gland secretes it, we know that it's an endocrine gland, kind of a circular argument. All right, so endocrine glands produce and secrete hormones. Okay, so we're going to talk about what a hormone is, and we're going to look at a number of endocrine glands in this particular chapter. Okay, so endocrine glands have a certain kind of structure to them. They are what we call ductless glands. They produce a product and secrete it from the cell that goes just into the extracellular space, and there it would stay, but in that extracellular space, it's near a capillary, so that product gets absorbed by a capillary, and when it gets absorbed by a capillary, it gets into your circulatory system, and then where does it go? Everywhere that your circulatory system goes. So an endocrine gland doesn't need a duct to transport its product because it has the circulatory system that will do that automatically, and it will transport it everywhere over the body. All right, so an endocrine gland is a ductless gland that secretes hormones into the bloodstream. So we need to work on the definition of a hormone just a little bit. All right? And we'll use our understanding of an endocrine gland to do that. A hormone comes from a ductless gland, right, which then gets secreted or picked up by the blood, delivered everywhere, and it's going to leave another capillary. What can you tell me, what's the functional significance of a capillary? What happens at a capillary compared to an artery or a vein? Exchange takes place, remember, because a capillary is really thin, it's got holes depending on the kind of capillary it is, so capillaries are leaky. Things can only enter and leave the circulatory system at a capillary. Can't enter or leave an artery, can't enter or leave a vein because the walls of veins and arteries, venules and arterioles are way too thick to allow for exchange. Okay? So when a hormone gets into the blood, it can leave the blood through another capillary in some distant location in the body. And it's just controlled by diffusion, by concentration gradient. All right, so now you have maybe a hormone that's secreted in the brain, and it's gone down to this ovary right here, and it can leave and enter the ovary. If the concentration of that hormone is less in the ovary than it is in the blood, it will enter the ovary. And then the ovary can respond to that signaling compound if it has something. What does that tissue have to be in order to be called a target tissue? It's got to have a receptor which has to match up the shape of what that signaling or that what that hormone is. And the hormone has to bind to that receptor before it can change the physiology of that target tissue or that target cell. Okay. So a hormone is something that's secreted by a ductless gland that's distributed by the circulatory system, and it can affect a target tissue if that target tissue has a receptor for it. Okay, and we look at some schemes for how receptors can change activity inside of a cell. Sometimes they can open ion channels, sometimes they can activate G proteins, and then change the activity of enzymes inside the cell like we saw for the rod cell not just too long ago. Okay, all right, so that's what a hormone is. That's a strict definition of a hormone. Okay, but there's also something, okay, in the brain, so there are neurons that and can release a signaling compound. What kind of signaling compounds are you familiar with that neurons can release, specifically at a synapse? Okay, a specific example would be acetylcholine, but what's a general name for acetylcholine and norepinephrine and serotonin and things like that? Those are neurotransmitters, right? So what's the difference between a neurotransmitter and a hormone? A neurotransmitter doesn't get picked up by the blood. It just diffuses across the synapse, right? But it is a chemical that's released by a neuron, right? But now there are some compounds. We talked about that in the autonomic nervous system. Norepinephrine released by the adrenal medulla, okay, norepinephrine you're familiar with because it's a neurotransmitter, but when it's released from the adrenal medulla, it gets picked up by the cardiovascular system. It gets picked up by a capillary, and then norepinephrine is transmitted everywhere in the body, and it can diffuse out another capillary just down its concentration gradient. Norepinephrine can bind to a distant target tissue if that distant target tissue has a receptor for it. So now we have a compound that's kind of acting like a hormone because it's being distributed by the circulatory system, but it's been released by a neuron, so it really is a neurotransmitter as well. So what do we call something that is part hormone and part neurotransmitter? Because it has characteristics of both. Yeah, then it's what we call a neurohormone, right? So norepinephrine can act strictly as a neurotransmitter or as a neurohormone if it gets distributed by the cardiovascular system. And indeed, many textbooks don't separate the endocrine system and nervous system into two separate chapters like we do in this book. We actually consolidate them together because they function together. And that adrenal medulla is one example where the nervous system and endocrine system really function as one system together, right? So the language kind of evades us a little bit. Okay, so here is a nice table of various endocrine glands. We get to talk about some of these endocrine glands, but you should at least read this table over and know what endocrine glands are secreting what kinds of hormones and what the primary target tissue is, or the target organ, and something is a target organ if it has a receptor, something that just matches up in shape to the signaling compound, and then what some of the effects of these different hormones are on the physiology of the target tissue or target organ. Okay, but I'm going to go over some of these, and then after we go over them, then it will make a lot more sense. But something I do want to point out, okay, which is probably really important in this class, and I think I mentioned that one of the most important concepts is that of antagonism. Because what does antagonism provide for in your body? Precise control and balance, musculoskeletal control over your fingertip, right, due to the balance of your biceps and triceps, and the antagonistic control of the autonomic nervous system. How many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have?
Two.
And they're usually what? Antagonistic to each other, which is a good thing. Okay, well, even the endocrine system has those same parallels with the musculoskeletal system and nervous system. For instance, let's look at insulin and glucagon from the pancreas right here. These control blood glucose levels. Okay, where does it say that? Promotes, yeah, blood glucose, and other kinds of things that have the effect on blood glucose. Insulin decreases blood glucose, and since they're antagonistic now, you could tell me what glucagon does. It increases blood glucose. Okay, and we're going to kind of look at that mechanism. So built into the control of blood glucose is antagonism due to the endocrine system, right, and that's produced by the pancreas, the islets of Langerhans, a couple different cells in the islets that do that. All right, so we're going to compare, I'm going to try and pick on a number of hormone systems that are antagonistic to each other so that you can get that sense of balance and control inside your body. Okay, but before we get to that, let's classify some hormones. There can be amine hormones, and amine hormones contain what? An amino group on them, and some of the amino acids that have an amino group from either tyrosine or tryptophan. I think we talked about these already. Norepinephrine, epinephrine, thyroxine, which we haven't talked about yet, and melatonin, important hormones that require these amino acids. And these are essential amino acids, so you have to have them in your diet in order to produce these hormones. But what else can you tell me about norepinephrine and epinephrine? They're not just hormones, they are also neurotransmitters. Okay. There can be some protein or polypeptide hormones in a polypeptide is just a shorter amino acid chain compared to a protein. And these include antidiuretic hormone, growth hormone, insulin is a polypeptide, oxytocin, glucagon. Remember, insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other. adrenal corticotropic hormone and parathyroid hormone. All right, so I think that might be the last time that I actually say adrenal corticotropic hormone. Okay, I'm just going to say ACTH, but I say it once because now you know what where this comes from, right? Or what the target tissue is. It's the adrenal cortex. And a trophic hormone is something that stimulates the growth of that target tissue and causes maybe secretion of a hormone from the adrenal cortex. Something funny just happened. Okay, microphone just went out. Okay, so the name is important for understanding what the action is. Antidiuretic hormone. Okay, what does a diuretic do? It produces urine, right? Dilute copious amounts of urine for you to void out of your urinary bladder. An antidiuretic is something that will help you conserve water, right? Will make very concentrated urine in small volumes. So antidiuretic hormone helps you conserve water. So it's good to know what these things really mean. There are some glycoproteins, which means that it's a protein that's been conjugated with a sugar molecule, and it changes the shape, so it's going to change its physiology. Luteinizing hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone, right, and thyroid-stimulating hormone are glycohormones. And then there are a whole bunch that are steroids. Right, so all of these right here, the three previous categories, these are hydrophilic hormones. Okay, and what does that mean to the cell if they're hydrophilic? Okay, they like water, but can they get inside of a cell? They can't get inside of a cell. But if it's a steroid hormone or a lipid-derived hormone, it's hydrophobic, which means what? It can enter the cell. So the receptors are going to, you're going to see are in two different locations for these different kinds of hormones, depending on what their nature is, either hydrophilic or hydrophobic. And here are some steroid hormones, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, cortisol. Okay, so how are these lipid steroids or the steroid-based hormones made? The base molecule starts with cholesterol. So y'all know that cholesterol is a bad molecule in your body because it can produce cardiovascular disease if it's in high concentration. But if you have no cholesterol in your body, what are some things that can't be accomplished? Well, you can't make cortisol. You can't make testosterone. Can't make forms of estrogen, right? So you have to have the proper amount because nobody wants to live a life without the proper levels of these sex steroids. All right, so we start with cholesterol, and then with some simple modifications, it's converted into progesterone. That's an important sex steroid. And then progesterone can be converted into cortisol, and progesterone can be converted into a testosterone molecule, andostenedione, and that can be converted very easily into testosterone. So I don't want you to memorize the structure of these things. I do want you to know that they're all related to each other. And furthermore, look at estradiol right here, which is a form of estrogen. Where does that come from? Testosterone. That's a modification of testosterone. All right, so all of these compounds will have various levels of activity and drastically different activities in your body with what? Just small changes. There's just a change in one proton right here between testosterone and estradiol. So small structural changes mean what? Big changes in physiology inside your cells. That's probably a pretty important take-home message. Okay. Thyroid hormones are also lipids. So here is a thyroid hormone. And thyroid hormone, in order to have proper activity, also has to be bound to an iodine. And this one right here, I see four iodines on this hormone. We call this thyroxine. We call it T4, or tetraiodothreonine. So it's a threonine that's been modified by adding these three iodine molecules. All right, so this is thyroxine, but it can exist in another form where it's missing one iodine right here. This is what we call T3, or triiodothreonine. One of these will have more activity than the other, but they're both fairly potent. But without at least three iodines on this molecule, then your body can't be producing any kind of competent form of thyroxine. Even though you have threonine in your diet, you also have to have iodine in your diet in order to make this particular signaling molecule from the thyroid gland. Okay, so some have some specific requirements like iodine for thyroxine. All right, so let's contrast and compare the nervous system with the endocrine system. And we saw that they work together in certain places of the body like the adrenal medulla. Both the nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. Right, so the nervous system uses neurotransmitters. Endocrine system uses hormones. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish one from the other, like the adrenal medulla, and hence we would call that a neurohormone. The difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is the method of transport. A hormone is transported by the blood, and a neurotransmitter works just by diffusion across the synaptic cleft. Okay. Some chemicals are used both as hormones and neurotransmitters, and you should probably be able to tell me the name of one, okay, that can be used as both, depending on circumstances and different organs in the body. Targets for both neurotransmitters and hormones must have a receptor somewhere on the cell or inside the cell in order to produce some kind of change in the physiology of that cell. Okay. Oh, that's something I forgot to mention. All right, so included in this definition of a hormone, okay, not only is it secreted by a ductless gland, not only is it transported by the blood, not only does it have to bind to a receptor, but when it binds to a receptor, something has to result from that binding. And that result is what? A specific change in the physiology of that cell, some kind of specific response. So if a molecule binds to receptor on the cell and it doesn't produce a specific response, then it's not a hormone. So a hormone has got to be what? Secreted by a ductless gland, transported by the blood, it's got to bind to receptor, and when it binds to that receptor, the critical last thing that I forgot to mention is that it produces a specific response in that target tissue. It's going to change the physiology of that target tissue somehow or another. And then one last criteria right here that's kind of important. There must be some way to rapidly inactivate, okay, that signaling compound, both for the neurotransmitter or for the hormone, because otherwise then that target tissue would be poisoned for the rest of its lifespan. All right, so there's got to be some way to inactivate it. Let's see what the next slide. Okay, one more slide. Hormone interactions. All right, a tissue can respond to a number of hormones if it has a number of different kinds of receptors, right? That's the only way that it can respond to a number of different kinds of hormones. If it only has a receptor for one hormone, then it can only respond to one hormone, right? But if there are a number of receptors on a cell, then these two hormones could be synergistic if they work together to produce the same kind of response, the same kind of specific response. And we consider that to be synergism if they produce a response that's larger in effect together than if we just add the individual effects together. So synergism means there's some potentiation of the effects of when these two hormones are acting together. And one hormone might not have any kind of specific response, but it might allow the specific response from a second hormone to have an effect. And if that's the case, then we say a hormone has a permissive effect if it enhances the responsiveness of the target organ to a second hormone. So it just allows a first hormone, if it allows the second hormone to have an effect, we call that a permissive effect. But of course, there is antagonism. If one hormone inhibits the effect of another, then that is antagonism. And again, you have to have a couple different kinds of receptors for those two different hormones, because those hormones will have a different shape. All right, so we're going to start with mechanisms of hormone action next time. And this is going to remind you of enzyme activity just a little bit. Okay, so the sign-in sheet is going around. Sign the sign-in sheet. And that's it for lecture today.